Good afternoon and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 30th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon, Jan Hughes continues her series called Discovering Your Secret Self. Today's topic is entitled 12-Step Practice. This is session HUJ 2000-4. Let's listen in.
And this is a workshop, Discovering Your Secret Self 12-Step Practice. And I want to start by saying, hi, I'm Jan, and I'm a codependent.
Hi, Jan.
Good. That's his cue. Are any of y'all familiar with 12-Step Practice? Okay, good. I want you to help me out. One of the most beautiful things about 12-step fellowships is the wonderful lore of stories and slogans, you know, let go, let God, you know, keep it simple, stupid. I mean, there are just so many different things. So whatever comes up for you, please don't hesitate to share. What I'm gonna do is present the 12 steps one by one and make some comments that I've learned on each one. But I did want to start by a brief history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because all week long I've been presenting on Carl Jung and his thoughts about how we keep a watch on our unconscious side. And Jung had a part in the foundation of the 12 steps. I don't know if y'all knew that. A way long time ago, in fact, I'm going to put on my glasses. Eyes don't work anymore without these. AA was established in 1935 in Akron, Ohio. 4 years prior to that, an alcoholic named Roland H., who was a young, talented financial wizard, you know, really a guy on Wall Street that was making it happen, but he was an alcoholic. And he flew to Zurich, Switzerland to consult with Carl Jung, the most renowned psychologist of his time. I mean, just imagine being able to go get sessions with Carl Jung. And Carl Jung worked with Roland H. for about a year, which shows you he had some money. And he made good progress. He did very, very well. But the moment he left and went back to New York, he started drinking again. So he wrote to Carl Jung and he said, is there any hope for me? You know, can I come back? And I think he even went back and consulted him some more. And this is what Bill Wilson, later on, Bill Wilson, one of the major founders, very famous, Bill W., of Alcoholics Anonymous, wrote to Jung in 1961. And I'm going to quote him. He said, that conversation between you and Roland that was to become the first link in the chain of events that led to the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. First of all, Bill says to Carl Jung, you frankly told him of his hopelessness. It's like Jung said, you are hopeless. There is no hope for you. You're going to die an alcoholic. So far as any further medical treatment or psychiatric treatment might be concerned. But Roland had asked Jung, is there any other hope for me? If there's no medical and there's no psychiatric, is there any hope? And Jung said, yes, perhaps religious. Perhaps if you have a spiritual conversion, there might be hope for you. And that was the first moment. They talk about four founding moments in Alcoholics Anonymous. Carl Jung saying, you are hopeless, but if you have a conversion experience, there might be hope, was the first founding moment. Roland then went on to join a group called the Oxford Group. Now, the Oxford Group was a religious movement that was very, very successful crossing Europe at that time. And the contribution of the Oxford Group to AA was they had a big emphasis on self-survey, confessions, restitution, and the giving of oneself to service. So think about that, and as we go through the steps, you'll see their influence. Self-survey, confessions, restitution, and service to others. So here we have an alcoholic in New York 4 years earlier than Bill W.
What might be of interest is the Oxford Group, one of the founders of that group was a pastor by the name of Frank Buckman, who was a Lutheran pastor in Pennsylvania.
Is that wonderful? And then there was Carl Jung was the son of a Lutheran pastor. I mean, we've got some Lutheran roots in this thing, don't we? I didn't know that. I appreciate that. For me, and the way I look at this is I believe the Holy Spirit moved among a bunch of broken people in the early 30s that led to the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1935. The way the steps were written, the way they were shaped, the way it came out of different... It's how we Lutherans speak of the living word, we speak to one another. And, you know, my perspective of God is that he just keeps trying. You know, I mean, Christ came, and some people can't get that. So now, you know, in Akron, Ohio, in 1935, God said, okay, let's see if we can get to these people in another way. And that's how I see the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My own involvement in the 12 steps was about 10 years ago. I was at the end of a very bad marriage that was dead a long, long time before I realized that. But I had become a therapist, and I joined Codependence Anonymous for Helping Professionals. The Central Office of Codependence Anonymous allows there to be chapters that are not widely advertised for helping professionals, because by the nature of what a therapist does, it might be difficult to see your client tonight and then see you in session tomorrow. So we had a group of therapists that met, and I credit finding the ELCA, and then very soon, I was in group therapy for about 6 months, about the next year, I spent a year in CODA for helping professionals. It saved my life, absolutely saved my life. And Paul, my husband here, I think you'll know him by now, adult child of an alcoholic. You were involved in Alateen when your father was in AA when you were a teenager.
Beginning at age 15, that was the turning point in my life.
And what we have done with these steps is we have taken them as our personal practice, our personal spiritual practice. But I have to tell you, every time in my recovery that I start getting puffed up about how good I'm doing, that is exactly when things are going to slide. And here at Holden, Paul and I went to the 12-step meeting earlier this week. And this is going to sound so dumb, but I tend to be a perfectionist, you know? I judge myself on how well I'm doing. You know, a workshop shouldn't be just good. No. It has to be the best I have ever done before. Or I have a lot of self-criticism. Well, went to that 12-step group and heard, once again, progress, not perfection. Now, how did I forget that? Tell me, if I know these steps so well, how did that slip out of my consciousness? So Paul and I have been saying progress, not perfection. It didn't slip out of your consciousness, but it slipped out of mine. And I'm going to start my journaling every week, every day that I do now. Progress, not perfection, Jim. This, for me, this is what it's all about. It's about continuing to keep an eye on yourself, because things do fall out of our consciousness. And we forget what we used to know. But we're not doing it anymore. Is this not true? Yeah, I think so. I want to go right to going through the steps. I put in my announcement at dinner, Bob S., one of the co-founders. Bob was the physician. He was the physician that Bill W. met. The two of them are considered the two core founders. He said you can sum up these 12 steps in 6 words: trust God, clean house, help others. I use this a lot in session with clients because, you know, even if they're not 12-step kind of people, on your handout, did everybody get one of these 12 steps? Did you get one of these? Okay. The first 3 steps are the trust God part, and we're going to go into those a little more deeply. Then 4 to 9 is the clean house, cleaning the internal house, cleaning our act up, essentially. There is no way to stop feeling guilty if you're continuing to do the very thing that makes you beat yourself up for doing. It's just essential that in some kind of way we clean this house out. And then what early Alcoholics Anonymous came to see is none of that up to step 9 would do you any good if you then didn't take the service to others. They found out that was the piece. Bob S. had been involved in the Oxford group for years before he met Bill W., and it wasn't working. It wasn't working. The piece that was missing was taking it to others who suffer. And so there you have it, kind of. If you don't remember anything else, you can remember 12 steps in 6 words, and you don't have to really remember what all the separate little steps are. But having said that, we can get into, one more thing. This is my favorite Bible verse. This is from St. Paul, Romans 7:15. I do not understand my own actions. I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now, can anybody relate to that? I adore that Bible. I'd like to talk to Paul about that. There's a lot of speculation on what did he mean by that, Pastor? Just what was it that he kept doing? But we won't go there today. We do that at dinner. We'll speculate on St. Paul. Step one. Would somebody read step one, please?
We admitted we were powerless over our attachments, that our lives had become unmanageable.
In many groups, like here at Holden, we would just hold. We would say, we admit that we were powerless, and we would hold, so that each kind of 12-step fellowship can fill that blank in. To put our attachments there, and I have another version, a pastor I knew, well, he also said our attachments. You can put anything you want there. You can even say, we admit that we are powerless. It doesn't matter. All of us have something that we are powerless over. This may sound, to a lot of people that are new, this sounds, it sounds like giving in. It sounds like giving up or something like that. But we Lutherans know that there's a paradox to that. There's a paradox to saying I'm powerless. Somehow, when you can get to that point, we can be powerful. That wonderful paradox of the cross in my weakness, you mentioned this week, I'm strong. This is a very hard step for many, many people. Paul, you test a lot of addicts, and when they come in from their treatment programs, you ask them what step are you on. So if you have anything you want to add at any point about any of this,
please do.
Just jump right
in.
And that goes for everybody. Number two. Someone read number two.
Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity.
One thing that is beautiful about this is called the hope step. And there's two stumbling blocks here for a lot of people. One is this power greater than ourselves. A lot of people who have been raised in abusive homes or have had terrible things, they have a hard time approaching that. The second thing is insanity. A lot of people have a hard time thinking, my life is insane. I personally don't have this problem. It feels a lot like my life is insane in terms of too busy and things like that. I had a friend in college named Scott, and he was a tremendous alcoholic. But you know, in college, none of us noticed. We were all drank. I mean, out of college, it was terrible how college students drank. But when we got to graduate school, he had a full scholarship to the University of Texas Law School, and he drank himself into a stupor. And we didn't even want him to come over because he would pass out on our sofa. Well, Scott had been raised by fervent Church of Christ parents, he told me. And it was not pretty. And he said he would lock himself in the bathroom on Sunday morning so they wouldn't get him out and take him. And it was just, both of his parents were alcoholics. It was ugly. And he could not conceive of God. He was an atheist. He absolutely could not conceive of God. You know, any God that he would imagine would have been just too terrible. Well, after Scott flunked out of school, it did turn out years later, because I started avoiding him. I mean, he lost all his friends. I mean, it was bad. I later saw him after he got into AA, and he told me that his higher power was the group initially. That AA itself, that just the meetings, just the group had to be the higher power that he used. He said, and I saw him about 5 years after that he had gotten into AA, he said that he had become to believe in a higher power, and it did. He said, if I don't think about it too hard, I can have it. But if I think about it too hard, I can't have it. Those are the kind of woundedness that people have, that we can't just bring them into our ALCA congregation, you know? And that is a lot about step two and what makes it very, very difficult.
I've heard insanity defined in 12-step as doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Is what it's saying. This is not talking about psychosis or anything here.
That reminds me of that.
The self-defeating things we do, all do.
Yes. It reminds me of that joke about therapy, you know, that life is one damn thing after another, but when it becomes the same damn thing day after day after day, that's when you need to go to counseling. That's what I heard. All right, step three, someone read that.
Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God.
Made a decision. You know, when you do a step study, it's really quite wonderful. And go to the group and step study 9. Often open meetings are step studies. You look at every little word. Now, let me say this about step two. Came to believe. When 12 steps were first written, Bill W. had written, "We believed." But then he realized, oh, no, no, no. We came to believe. It's hard to believe. It's like we talk about faith and doubt in the Lutheran Church. We came to believe. It's a process. It's all a process, the entire 12 steps. Here it is, made a decision. In a step study, you would say, what does that mean, decision? You know, what does that mean to turn our will? You would chop it up like a pericope study that pastors do, I guess. So when you look at scripture, you take little pieces and say, what does
this
mean?
Like Rabbi's Midrash.
Yes! Isn't that, I thought of that during the, yeah, it was beautiful. This make a decision thing, Paul and I see so many people in counseling get better after they take that plunge and make the decision. But this is only making a decision to turn your will over to God. This is only thinking. This is only like, I'm going to make a decision to do this. It's like, we can't really do that. We keep doing it. Every morning, get up, try it again, turning our will over.
I think this is often a step that Lutherans in particular have some difficulty with, because particularly theologically educated Lutherans, because there's a kind of implicit decision theology that's kind of, that goes against the grain for Lutherans. So that's something that I think we often struggle with. I noticed another thing in this particular step, and that the word control is never used. And I think that's a stumbling block to lots of people in general. To turn your life and your will to the care of God is a whole different thing.
Is that beautiful?
Than to turn it to somebody else's control. That may have been what our experience was, and there is no way that we're going to do that.
What an excellent comment. I've never seen that before, but I see it now. Thank you. Anybody else on these first three steps?
I just have a question in general about these.
Uh-huh.
Why are they written in past tense instead of admit we are powerless, come to believe, you know, instead of there, it's already done? Is that, I'm sure
it's this is where I always hesitate to speak for AA or for Bill or anything, but my understanding is one of the things was that when Bill Wilson first wrote this, it said I came to, and then they changed it to we. Isn't that beautiful? And I think it is because what alcoholics came to understand is that Bill would go to another alcoholic, you know, the other alcoholic, let's say, is laying there in the gutter. They call it the man on the bed, usually laying in the bed, you know, waking up with a hangover. And Bill would say, this is my story. This is my story. So what they're saying is, this is our history. This is how we as Alcoholics Anonymous came to be and came to understand. This is the path that we found. Whatever way you can find this. So I think it's like a historical comment.
I was talking to a woman the other day who's a heroin addict. And she's been clean of that sort for a while because, of course, it made her be clean. And she said to me, she said, I'm still working on the first step.
Mm-hmm.
She's not there yet,
mm-hmm.
but she's working.
So when she is there, she'll stay this way.
Yeah.
And you can take as long as you want on each individual step. In 12-step groups, you have a sponsor, and Bill W. specified should be someone of the same sex as you. And the reason for that is that in the course of this process we're going to talk about, you get very close, very spiritually close with your sponsor. And if it's male and female, you know, it can get very messy. It's like, don't even go there. You know, don't even have that. Actually, a sponsor in a 12-step fellowship is a spiritual director. A spiritual director that's just a little ahead of you. You know, and a very important relationship. One thing Paul always asks the people that you're testing for the Texas Rehabilitation Commission is, do you have a sponsor yet? As someone to hold you accountable, someone to mentor you, someone you can, you know, can be there with you, very important kind of thing. And not always an easy thing to find. Well, plenty of people that want to do, plenty of, I shouldn't say not an easy thing to find, but maybe not an easy fit. And sometimes sponsors relapse too. Any other comments? These comments are excellent. Before we go on. These first three steps, very, very important, have been up here in the head. They have been within the person. These are the thoughts. These are the turning over, the trust God. Very big thing. And you can't go on, you can't leap over trust God and plunge into step four. That would be disastrous. Got to do them just in the order that they are, which is about the only recommendation. The thing about a 12-step group is there really isn't any hard and fast rules. Everybody does it their own way. It's interesting enough, though, if you ever want to read Not God, it's the History of Alcoholics Anonymous. Have you read that? Excellent book. Yeah. Excellent. There's kind of a fundamentalist group of AA. And I had a client once, a recovering alcoholic, who said to me, my group says I have to get on my knees at night and fold my hands like this when I pray. And I was like, that's not Alcoholics Anonymous. He was going to a fundamentalist AA group, you know, and they call that, I can't remember now, I think it's the Akron group, isn't
Christians
it?
Christians Victorious.
It's very, very interesting, but it shouldn't be that way. That wasn't Bill W.'s vision anyway. It was like, there's no hard and fast rule, every person finds their way. These are just suggestions.
The other, I used to be in that place about those people. So my sponsor said to me, he said, well, at least we're in a 12-step program.
Yeah. Proper, not perfection. Absolutely. Wonderfully attempts not to judge in that group. All right, now you may have heard of this next step. This is very, very important. Step 4. Someone read step 4.
Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves.
Searching and fearless moral inventory. A very, very important step. This is the piece about self-knowledge. This is indeed going inside and dredging up every possible thing that you may have inside you that is bringing you a level of shame or regret or resentment. Resentments, and those nagging little angers, those little things that are hanging on to you. I would refer you here and in always to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Chapter 5 is called How It Works. And in chapter 5 of the big book, they go over the 12 steps. So I really encourage you to get a copy of the big book and look at that chapter 5 for a really tight understanding of all this. Any of you familiar, have you heard of the Enneagram? Yes, the Enneagram is a tool that the Catholic Church began using for spiritual direction. The Enneagram is a type system that has a rather strange looking like a pentagram thing. It's 9 personality types. 7 of them are attached to the traditional deadly sins of the church. There's 2 extra ones in the Enneagram, and the thought is that they're the 2 sins that we Western people overlook, deceit and anxiety. Do you remember the other 7 sins? They are anger, pride, envy, greed, gluttony, lust, and sloth. And in that system, and now that you've heard the word Enneagram, when you go to the bookstore, you're going to see Enneagram books, you know, if your eyes are open to them in the self-help sections now. The idea is that each personality type has 1 sin that is their favorite, so to speak. The 1 sin they most. Some people struggle with anger, some people struggle with pride, like that. I'm just offering to you, the Enneagram is a good tool for doing a fearless moral inventory. It kind of helps you get a handle on it. The Myers-Briggs type indicator gives you personality styles that are really positive and healthy. The Enneagram, I'm very careful when I use it in therapy because, somebody even said, you want to teach the Enneagram at Holden? And I did not want to because I didn't think in 4 hours you can do justice to such a powerful tool because I've seen it rip people in 2 that are using it in a moral inventory kind of way. So what go ahead.
Often ask people to think about things that they do when they're sober that complicate their lives as a way of identifying some of those things that and being a little different tack than what the Enneagram does.
Right.
And lets people really kind of come to their own self-awareness with those things. I think, like you say, you can use the Enneagram in a way that rips people apart. Mm-hmm. And looking maybe at things that complicate your life is a little more gentle way of doing that.
Indeed. And I even have an exercise we're going to do when we get to step 10 that I'm going to share with you that you can look at your own life if you like. And I'm not recommending that anybody in this room do a step 4 if you don't want to. Another way people do is journal. Mm-hmm. Journal about your lives, the things that made you happy, the things that made you sad. Write your life history. Write down every good thing that you ever did, every bad thing you ever did. There's many ways. Oftentimes, people get a sponsor in a 12-step fellowship that helps them work through step 4. I've seen workbooks in bookstores mm-hmm. to help guide you through step 4 of this searching and moral inventory.
It's a good idea when you say, when they're sober, what do they do? Because yeah. then you're looking at really what we call relapse triggers.
Sure.
This is what we were looking
at. And core behaviors, things yes. that persist, you know, even if you're not drinking or using.
I have found this fourth step is a key one in my work, because I found that that people who are really serious about recovery and getting stronger are going to do the fourth and fifth step. That's like the stumbling block. Those who are not serious just never have the guts or commitment to do that, because it's really not an easy thing to do. It's something that most people would avoid doing. But it's necessary work, isn't it?
The interesting thing about this is before I discovered the 12 steps, I had returned to the church. I burned by fundamentalism as a teenager, basically kicked out of a fundamentalist church. I spent 16 years progressively into atheism, you know, young college student and young mother, and etc. Finally was brought back into the church, the ELCA. It was a wonderful and painful journey back into that. But before I even knew the 12 steps, I was sitting in church one day, a brand new baby Christian again, and I heard the Bible verse that said, if you have a problem with your brother, or sister, I guess our NRSV would say, go make it right, and then bring your offering back to the altar. And many years earlier, my biological father had stopped visiting me when I was 8 years old. And I had, and you can say this could have come out in an inventory, but I didn't know the 12 steps. I had a guilt in me as a child. I was adopted by my stepfather when I was 12, and I had a tremendous guilt. So even before I knew the 12 steps, I went and found my biological father. Now, what I found there was a lot of dysfunction that was not healthy at all, and I did not then go on to have a close relationship, but it didn't matter, because when you do what we're going to get to in a moment, I'm kind of skipped ahead with the way I went and found him, but you don't do it for the other person, you do it for your own recovery. I had a guilt inside me, so I went and found him and said, thank you for allowing me to be adopted. Thank you. Because it was good, and it was healing for him and for me and all that. All I'm saying to you is, I believe these steps, it's basic Christianity. It's like I was convicted in church by a Bible verse that is the right thing to do anyway. You know what I'm saying? I think the fourth step and what we're going into is the way to clean house on your soul. Whether you know the 12 steps or you don't know the 12 steps, I think in a Christian walk, you're going to be led to do that kind of way. And I wanted to give you that example also, because that was nothing I ever did. I was a child, and I didn't want to go over there. It was very dysfunctional, and I had a family. Not that it wasn't, but it was less dysfunctional than the other family was. And that was a resentment and a hurt and a guilt that I shouldn't have carried anymore, and it needed to be cleaned up. Does that make sense? So whatever a person does that's doing a four-step does the searching and fearless moral inventory. And then the next thing, any other comments about that? Any questions? So you have to have the support of God in the first three steps, or you can't face it. You can't face the fourth step and everything you've ever done and all of the anything you have inside you that you're ashamed of. You can't face it if you don't have the support of a higher power. Okay, number 5, someone read it.
Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs.
Now that we know the wrongs, to admit them to ourselves. Ooh, that's a tough one right there. But then to God, and then to one other human being. Doesn't say everybody. It doesn't say tell your mother and your father and your wife and everybody else. One other human being. Some people might use their pastor. A sponsor can be that one human being. A therapist is often. I have had, so I cannot even tell you the experience, and I know Paul's had it too, of people coming in and telling you their deepest shame. And you think to yourself, that
that's it.
Yeah, I mean, you've been carrying this for 10 years. And the reason you have to share it with somebody is so you can have that healing experience of somebody still caring about you after they have heard the biggest dirt you can dredge out and they're still with you. It's just a very, very important and healing experience. That makes sense?
I think also you want to make sure that you're doing this with somebody who understands 12 steps.
Absolutely.
You may want to caution this, and we talked about doing it with a therapist. In some states, there are mandated reporters of abuse. And in case you're thinking of doing it with a therapist, you may choose not to do that with a therapist. Perhaps do it with a pastor or a sponsor.
Yeah. That's a very good point.
In some states, they're not. So if you consider this, this is one to be take that into consideration.
Any other comments about step five? Step six.
We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character.
I still work on this one. What does it mean? Entirely ready. I was talking to Paul about this just the other day. I'm not sure I'm still entirely ready. God, remove all my defects. I like some of my defects. I do. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like entirely ready to have God remove. I mean, you know, these little resentments that you think, you know, it's not easy. I don't think step six is easy. In fact, many say step six and seven are not something we can even do. It's grace. And it comes to us. It's like this may be six and seven, maybe something that's done unconsciously. I don't know how y'all feel about that.
You're praising Bruce language at all. You're saying you're ready to have God do this, and you're asking God to do that. So.
Yeah, the next one is humbly ask God, okay, I'm to become entirely ready, and then to say, okay, God, go. That's, you know, that sounds so darn easy, but it is not. It's not any one of these steps are simple or easy in terms of our willingness to be cleansed. But my comments here that I wrote down, it must be ready for freedom. Without our defects and faults to blame, you know, like I can say, oh, well, you know, I've just never been good at doing something like that. You know, like you can blame some of your defects of character for reasons why you can't do this or can't do that. So if they were gone, what would we do? We might have to accept total responsibility for whatever.
Can be done by levels, like maybe go all the way through and then start all over again, seeing that there's more?
You know, I was talking with an experienced alcoholic in recovery about this, because I've actually gotten a quarrel with one of my clients, an experienced alcoholic in recovery. It's not a quarrel, I exaggerate when I say that. I asked him, because many people say, no, you do the steps 1 through 9 once. And then 10, 11, 12 remains. And that's why I asked him, because I personally believe that the first time you do the fourth step, you can do it kind of lightly.
Yes.
And then maybe later, as you grow in maturity and we get deeper understandings, then we do them again. And this experienced person told me the other day, yes, he sees it that way too, but it's like anything else. If you think you do it once, 1 through 9, that's okay too. It doesn't matter. But I personally believe you can go back and do them all over again on a deeper level than you did them before. That's been true for me. And that's why I'm saying I'm not sure I'm still entirely ready, even though I think I've done it all once. Okay, so we've asked God, we've identified our character defects, we've asked God to release us from that. The next step, would someone read number 8?
Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all.
That's probably a famous step that people have heard of. Goes with number 9. Go ahead and read 9 too.
Make direct amends to such people who have never, wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others.
So first we make a list and we become willing. There it is again. We become willing to make amends and then we make amends. Part of the reasons I think this is split out is because there is a judgment piece in there about, will my going to talk to this person hurt them? you know, it, there could be cases where going back could stir something up for somebody. And like, it's like, the question is, who's it for? And it's for the person that's doing the step work, and yet we do not want to harm any other human beings. So you make a list of everyone you want to say you're sorry to or whatever. I had an alcoholic client who had a quarrel with his boss. He blew up at his boss. And he went back the next day and said, you know, I am so sorry for what I did. This is alcoholic in recovery. I shouldn't have yelled at you like that yesterday. And the boss said, oh, forget it. It's okay. It was nothing. And he's like, no, you don't understand. This isn't for you. This is for me. He still had some personality issues. Progress, not perfection, is what we're saying here. But he did. It's like, if there's any, after you go through this process, if there's anything you do, then you clean it up right away. You don't let anything lie there dirty and pestering and making you feel guilty. You go and it gets to be a habit. Y'all have any comments about this?
Resentments fester all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, resentments will just drive you to drink or kill you faster than anything.
Absolutely. Making direct amends to those people that we can make amends to completes the cleaning house cycle. It's action steps first, the thinking and then the action steps about it.
I was thinking resentment is the one feeling I really try and inventory the most and just keeping track of, and because it is a cancerous emotion, isn't it? Just to track that and see, and always see it as a signal that you need to do something with it. Whether it's to go directly to that person if it's helpful or not hurtful to them, or just work at releasing and forgiving, you know, to do that too. That's, yeah.
The last three steps go into what Bob S. called help others. Someone read number 10.
Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it.
This is the point of that alcoholic who told me, no, you don't do 1 and 9 through, you do 10. 10 is the step where you continue doing 1 through 9, you know, forever. The idea here is we've got to stay free of resentment and guilt. We've got to live clean, essentially. And that means to continue to take personal inventory. Here's the thing. We have the 4-step inventory, that's the big one. We have daily inventory, a good practice that I try to do. This is where I was patting myself on the back so much. At night, when you're getting ready for bed, at the time that you say your prayers and ask for dreams, if you do that, to say, the dreams can help you notice if you've missed anything in your inventory, you know, show me if I'm one-sided somewhere. But to say, how did I live this day? What did I do that I'm proud of today? What did I do that didn't go well? Any amends I need to make today? That is the daily inventory. There's also an AA, the spot inventory. And that's like when you're in the midst and you just yell at your spouse, or the spot inventory. And it's more, the quicker you can make amends after you have done the thing, that very thing you hate that you're trying not to do, and the better, the cleaner that you'll feel on the inside. This is where that, some of you might have heard that Catholic, the Lutheran Catholic dialogues, when I was saying, we Lutherans, you know, we're justified. We don't have to do anything. You know, God's covered it all for us. And he said, what do you do after you're justified? To me, the 12 steps offer us a way to lead a clean and holy life. A daily spiritual practice of, how did this day go for me? Is there anything? You know, is God showing me anything? We try with our kids, even. Varying success, as Paul said, they're making progress, not perfection. To say, what character defect are you working on right now, kid? You know? And we're working on this or this or that.
I got a list for you.
But you know, we're trying.
Kids having therapists.
Oh, it is. We're trying to model for them that we are aware, and heaven knows they point out my defects of character quite well, you know.
That's
why God sent his children.
Yes, he age appropriateness for this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Sure. Yes.
And I worked with adolescents in treatment, and younger than 14, I just don't think that there's the capacity
for a lot of insight there.
Not for, yeah. Well, certainly below 11. It's that Piaget, that change over to abstract thinking. Yeah. But you know, little children, I work with children, they can work on sharing. You know, they can work, there are many things. You know, like our little one, she, when we say it's time to do chores, she gripes a lot. It's like, ooh, helpfulness. You know, there are things that I think even children, I'm not talking about great big things, but little behaviors, you know, a little more cooperation. Mm-hmm. What are you working on right now? Our 13-year-old, swings, nothing. She's working on bossiness. She's always working on bossiness.
Protecting that, no doubt.
But she'll tell you. She'll tell you that's what she's working on. Not that progress, not perfection. Okay, so step 10. There's a wonderful story. I love this. This came out of a person in Over Ears Anonymous. She was on an airplane. I'm doing okay on time, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. She was on an airplane, and she liked the mug. The mug, the airline shoes, she liked it a lot. She liked it a whole lot. And she decided, I want this mug. And so she finished it and she put it in her bag. You know, I'm just gonna slip it in here. And then she looked down and her mug was up against her book of 12 steps and 12 traditions. Mm. AA has 12 traditions. They have, one of them is that they don't own property. Churches could take a lesson. AA will not fight over property and money because they hold nothing. It's one of the traditions. We won't go there. But anyway, she's looking in her bag, and there's this mug right next to her book of 12 and 12. And she's writing, and she's thinking, that doesn't look good. And then the guilt, you know, this is not good. And so spot inventory, she takes the mug out, and she takes it to the stewardess. And she said, I really admired this, and I was going to take it, but I don't want to confess to you, please. And you know what the stewardess did? She said, here, take two. And so the woman went back and put the two mugs next to her 12 and 12, and she thought, yes, that looks good. I just love that story.
And now she has a collection of 50 because she does it every time.
It's a small thing, but it's about living clean and trying to live a life of integrity.
I mean, some awareness too. With people I counsel who have been in counseling before, sometimes if people have been in counseling for a year or two with other therapists, I just ask them early on, what character defects, issues did you identify, what did you work on? Because that tells me just how serious someone was about the work they've done. Because if they really can't identify anything other than to say, well, I talked about my abusive parents or whatever, then that really doesn't impress me as being serious internal work. That there's still, all the counseling they did was focusing on other people.
Right, out there, themselves. Out there blaming others, you know, what they did. You can hear this in people's speech, but I had to do this. You know, like I had no other choice, you know. A battering husband might say, I had to hit her. Mm. It's like, no, there were other options there for you at that moment. But step 11, please, someone, step 11.
Through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood God, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out.
This is the second thing that I had been convicted on at Holden by returning to a 12-step meeting. It's like I could hear in others that they are doing step 11, and my step 11 has been sliding lately. A daily practice of quiet time, a moment of stillness, so that God has a chance to get through to us. You know, what a beautiful thing. And that's one of the things on the airplane when we list what we're taking back from Holden. Drink more water, less carbonation. Number two, daily spiritual practice. It doesn't have to be long, but some time to have that kind of reflection. And number 12.
Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to persons enslaved by their attachments and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
In those brackets, a pastor I know who is a recovering alcoholic puts others who suffer. I love them, you know, to others who suffer. Doesn't matter what their issue is. So that's very beautiful. Couple of things in this, just the way it's written. A spiritual awakening you know, at first I believe, I can't remember exactly what he wrote, but it was like Bill Doty had written Conversion Experience, something like that. But then he marked through it, and they changed it to Spiritual Awakening. It's not like it's a done deal. It's like just an awakening, a new consciousness, an eyes opened kind of thing. It's really rather beautiful that it's put in that way. We try to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You know, not just in the 12-step meeting, but at work, at the office, wherever we are. A really beautiful thing. I want to read you something real quick called Acceptance by Vincent Collins. Because a lot of people, I got a call last week right before I got on the plane. This woman had been referred by her pastor to me. She has a daughter who rages all the time. And her husband is afraid of her and doesn't know what to do. And the whole family is thinking of what can they do? And so she's calling me, what can I do? And it's like, well, you know, your daughter, some, you know, her husband, I would suggest he might learn that there's something he can do for himself, Al-Anon way, something he can do, but nobody can help that woman if she's not going to ask for help. Here's what Vincent Collins says, y'all. I finally learned that you cannot help people unless they really need help, are willing to be helped, want you to help them, and ask you to help them. Did you hear all those four things? You can't help. You know, when they say, going to carry this message to help others, you can't help anyone who doesn't really need it, isn't willing to take it, doesn't want you to help them, and doesn't ask for it. And basically, that's what I've told her. You know, if your daughter can call me, you'd be glad to see her. I'd be glad to see the whole family, you know, in terms of an intervention together with the mother. But there's no way that I can tell this woman how to fix this daughter that's got the whole family in a spin. You see what I'm saying? In case there's anyone here that really has come hoping to help someone, if they don't ask for it, you can't. But you can, and this is the beauty of Al-Anon practice, you can do these steps yourself. And this is what we Christians need to do. In our joy, in our happiness within the Lutheran Church, others can see, oh, I want that too. In Al-Anon, when a person gets into Al-Anon and does the steps and begins living a healthier life, one of two things is going to happen. The dysfunctional, the alcoholic spouse will say, is either going to get into AA too, and that often happens, or they may end up splitting up. You know, or the Al-Anon person could continue living a better, happier life while the alcoholic continues drinking. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. This reminds me of just like how we are to witness as Christians. What is witnessing? Because witnessing is, I think, more powerful if we talk about our journey. And recovery, however you want to call it, is much more powerful than telling people what you think they need to do. It's kind of like with the kids. We do a lot of, sometimes the most effective thing we do is displacement communication, is what it's called. It's when you talk about what works for me. You know, you see them doing something that you know is really kind of stupid or whatever. And you don't have to tell them directly, but you can say, well, you know, that doesn't work for me. This is what I have learned that works for me. And then letting them choose. You know, giving them the free will to do that.
Absolutely. The healing that I got in CODA for helping professionals, it was so simple. The biggest thing was you're not allowed to crosstalk. You know, when you're in a group, what happens is everyone will go around, you know, hi, I'm Jen, I'm codependent. Everyone says, hi, Jen. Makes you feel okay. Then you talk about the topic or actually anything that you want to. And in the end, everyone just says, thank you. You know, thank you for sharing. And what we would do is we'd wait for the meeting to be over and then we'd run down to the parking lot and tell each other, do you know what I think you ought to do about that is, you know, because you're not allowed to crosstalk. And it was very interesting when you sit in meetings week after week, not allowed to crosstalk, and sometimes you're feeling really good, stress me, and I've seen it in AA meetings too, that people are like really wanting to offer advice or a, you know, friendly word, not allowed to. You find, you know what you do? You start talking I. You know, if someone would share something, I see a nod over here and a smile, you know what I mean? This one will say, well, last night my wife and I had a big fight. And so when it was your turn, you might say, I've had a fight like that too. And boy, was that hard. And you find that you help others like Bill Wilson did, not by saying, you poor alcoholic, you need to get out of that bed and get some help. No, by saying, I have been there. I know that hurt. You tell your story. It's a very beautiful thing. And I don't think in my dysfunctional family of origin I would have ever learned it, except in a 12-step meeting where crosstalk is prohibited. Never mind the parking lot. Had to get out of there for that. Now, I gave you a handout, and I did not keep one for myself. Thank you so much. Patrick Carnes wrote a great book. Okay, that's good. I mean, that'll be great. Because I'm just going to offer this. We don't even have to do this exercise here or anything. Patrick Carnes wrote Out of the Shadows about sexual addiction. And Paul can tell you a big problem that we're having, a lot of people presenting for, is addiction to pornography on the internet. Addiction to the internet. You know, but also, I mean, it's, pornography is there. I mean, it pops up. I mean, you're not even looking for it. And a lot of people are...
Child Protective Service, we're seeing kids doing these bizarre things, and they have not been molested. They've been watching it.
They've been watching it.
It's horrible. It's a serious problem. And it's quite an addiction. Patrick Carnes was the first. It's rather an old book, Out of the Shadows. And I saw it on the sale rack over there, several copies of it. But essentially, this is the second book he wrote, and I'm forgetting the it's Gentle Path Through the 12 Steps, but you can see it's pretty old too, 1989, and it was after Out of the Shadows. What I loved about this comes out of the chapter that he's talking about continuing to take the inventory. You know, this is for people whose lives are, you know, been through 1 through 9, now we're in the maintenance phase. And he says that you can use this as a tool, because when your life is out of balance, little bits of craziness are going to start popping up in several areas of your life. Now, I don't know about you, but when I found this, I thought, well, my life's pretty crazy right now, and I'm going to clean it up when I go back down Lake from Holden, because I think I've got my center back here. Let's just look at these. Physical health, overweight, coffee or caffeine abuse. Did this ring a bell with anybody? Eating junk food. We here at Holden, we're really working on this mice, but I really want to hold it. I have slept better here than I can have slept in I don't know how long, soundly, wonderfully, with the exercise and the good food. I like the food, by the way. Transportation, do you rush around? Do you speed? Are you darting from appointment to appointment? Does this resonate for anyone here? I won't look at some, I know, but...
They don't speed very much.
Only when you're in the car. That's not true. But environment, plants not watered. I had a little bit of that. You preparing for Holden, I noticed my poor plants. Obviously, they had been neglected for some time. Laundry not done, grocery shopping. Have you had weeks when you're thinking, we've got to quit running to the store for bread and milk? We've got to get in there and do the big shopping. Does that ever happen at your house? Work, not returning phone calls in 24 hours, missed deadlines, all those. I mean, these are areas that I think come up for a lot of people. Now, what Carnes is saying is, it's kind of maybe a four-step a little bit here, too. Sit down and write in each of these sections 3 examples of ways that you can get crazy. You may not be doing it right now, but signs for you in each of these areas that maybe your life is too busy or whatever. And then pick out the 7 best ones. You know, out of all of these 10 areas, you know, checkbook not balanced, you haven't gotten around to doing that for a while, or you haven't seen your friends in a long time, you see these different areas, pick out 7. And then keep a checklist every day. Give yourself points for the things that you did well. You see what I'm saying? And then at the end of a week, at the bottom, you can add up your score. He said if you forget to count the negative behaviors, these 7 core behaviors that you're watching for, if you forget to count them on a day, you get 7 points for that day. Because obviously you were too darn busy to count your 7 symptoms that you're watching. So you get a whole 7 points for that day. And then at the end of the week, you can see how you're doing. And you can see at the bottom, you know, optimum health. I did this before I came, and we're not too bad. We were like 20 you know, I think something like that, or I was like 20. I say we. See, there's a problem. See, I just had a little a mesh.
There's all a point for that.
7 points.
That's right.
Well, when we served church our day, Paul said that I was so controlling because I would say, let's do this.
Beware of people who use words like we and let's.
Let's go instead of, you know, more forcefully speaking, but it's the same thing, right? A little controlling behavior. Anyway, I thought that was a neat little index of kind of keeping an eye. And if we find we're doing too many of those 7 core symptoms, whatever it is for us, well, then perhaps we need to take a little spiritual retreat some kind of way, even though we can't get comfortable for a while. Any please comment or any response? Any other questions about 12-step fellowships?
One of the things I thought I've been thinking about the step work, one thing that a quote from Luther, who said, we should be grateful that the Holy Spirit does not reveal to us all our evil at once.
Absolutely. Isn't that true?
And second, I wish I read somewhere that the greatest of saints are not those that feel like they are improving, but those that increase in the awareness of their weakness and sinfulness over time. There's some story about St. Francis weeping in prayer and then laughing hilariously and weeping and laughing. And he was approached after, says, well, when I was weeping, there would be one, there was one, I had a vision of one light would shine, would show me, you know, and I would see how I was, and then the next light might shine and show Christ. And here Francis was, you know, considered the holiest, you know, meekest and most.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
And yet considered himself to be, well, not particularly a liar.
Absolutely.
I got to tell one more quick story.
Okay.
He had one of his followers, or Brother Giles or something, came into this town where they were looking for an escaped prisoner. And, you know, they dressed kind of ragged, so they grabbed him and they said, you know, are you the guy that killed that one person over there? He said, well, I don't remember, but certainly I would have done that if I'd had the chance.
I'm so guilty. But you know, what I believe about spiritual practice, what I love about being Lutheran, is everything in moderation, you know? We are allowed to drink, but we drink with moderation. We drink with grace. That's what I heard. We drink gracefully. And it's about knowing your weaknesses, but not beating yourself up for them. You know, that. What did Luther say, saints and sinners we are?
Final usus et peccata, simultaneously righteous and sinful.
And to hold that in a balance and then to continue to look, that is the thing. And that is why I offer to you the 12 steps as a wonderful daily practice for everyone.
Can I make a quick announcement?
Please.
I'm playing some songs that are basically about 12-step recovery in the lift this evening at 9 o'clock. From some music, some songs I've written. So if anyone feels like if you're bored with the swing dance. And you want, the lift is way down kind of in the, by the snack bar out there, kind of in the lower level is where it is. You'll find it down in that end of the building down there.
You listen, every good sermon and every good song, like you're going to be singing, has the 12 steps in them. And you'll hear it now as you listen to preaching, good preaching. We'll have the 12 steps. Maybe they just won't be late itself. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your attention. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for those.